With start of school tomorrow, I guess summer vacation season has come to its end. Maybe some of you traveled this summer, and if you did, perhaps you went to Washington, D.C. And if you did, I hope that you went to one of my favorite places in this nation, that is our very own Capitol. When you go in the Capitol building and you're touring around the main floor before you go into either the House or the Senate chamber, you probably walk through Statuary Hall, which is, as it were, a kind of temple, a pantheon, if you will, to famous Americans. Each state gets to send two statues, and some people, you know, being enormously famous in the 1800s, got in really fast, and now we've managed to forget all about who they are, and states probably kind of want to trade who they get to send to Washington. But there you are, that Statuary Hall, this pantheon of famous Americans. The first verse we heard read today, "Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph," fits in that pantheon of famous Bible verses. Now, some we've managed to forget, but others we remember. "A new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph" goes right alongside other famous verses like, "In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth," or "In the springtime of the year when kings go out to war," or "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne." All of these verses give way to longer, richer narratives that are constitutive of the story of God and God's people. Now, perhaps "a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph" is not quite as famous as these other verses, but it has the same effect. This verse tells us that something new, something important, something life-changing is about to unfold. This verse is a hinge verse, coupling what has gone before with what is yet to come. In this case, what lies past is the story of Joseph, who, as you may recall, goes from being a precocious, snarky, smart-alecky, but very idealistic 17-year-old who was sold by his brothers to slavery in Egypt, to being a very savvy, very wise, very prudent elder statesman, second in Egypt only to the Pharaoh himself. Perhaps you'll recall, too, that Joseph's dramatic rise to the very heights of power was predicated on what the important 20th century theologian Andrew Lloyd Webber, pause for laughter here, there it comes, called a flair for economic planning. Indeed, it was Joseph's God-given ability to interpret dreams that enabled him to foresee an impending drought and a subsequent famine. It led him to suggest Pharaoh to devise a plan that would enable Egypt not only to survive, but really to thrive during this incredible natural disaster. And in fact, it turned out just the way Joseph had said that it would. For quite a long time, Egypt saved. The national savings rate was a very impressive one, quite above the national American average. And when the drought came and the famine struck, Egypt had magnificent stores of grain, so much so that they could feed not only their own population, but sell grain to foreign populations. And so, as a gift of a grateful nation, Pharaoh allotted to Joseph and to his now reconciled brothers the land of Goshen, Goshen being an agriculturally rich and productive area in Egypt, and this would be the land that these immigrants would call their own. It was here in the land of Goshen that the extended family of Joseph, the children of Israel, were fruitful. They were fertile, they were prolific, they multiplied, they increased, they spread out over the land so that the whole land was filled with them. Frankly, it sounds a lot like Rush Limbaugh and Michelle Bachmann's immigration nightmare come true. Granting amnesty to immigrants only leads them to think of Egypt as home, where they decide to stay and begin to prosper. Only unlike the Limbaugh-Bachman party line, these immigrants don't consume public resources. They don't take jobs otherwise available to the natives. But over time, as history progressed, sure enough, a new king arose over Egypt who didn't know Joseph. A king who, as Sam Cooke famously sang, didn't know much about history, or at least about the history of the racial and religious minority in his land. He didn't know about Joseph, who had saved Egypt from economic and political collapse. Joseph, who had prevented Egypt from defaulting on its loans, thereby losing its AAA credit rating. Joseph, who brought a balanced approach to cutting spending and raising revenue, and thereby averting mass starvation, social unrest, and a weakening of Egypt's global dominance. The new king of Egypt didn't know any of those things, and so he couldn't appreciate the contribution made to Egyptian national, political, and economic life made by these troublesome Israelites. Instead, the new king saw the fruitful, fertile, prosperous, powerful Israelites not as a blessing, but as a threat. They were a threat numerically, and numbers, even in a divine monarchy like Egypt, mean power. A large and growing middle class that is increasingly wealthy begins to want choices, to have a say in how they are governed, to have an opinion about the direction in which the country is going. Some of them become so prosperous and so concerned about tax rates, they form little tea parties. But an economically empowered and foreign-born population might very well decide that they have had enough of the powers that be. They might decide to ally themselves with foreign powers. They might grow restless. They might vote the rascals out of office, or worse, they might rise up against the very powers, and Pharaoh could not have that. A growing resident immigrant population threatened the Egyptian way of life. And so Pharaoh set out to, quote, deal shrewdly with the Israelites. Deal shrewdly being one of those government euphemisms like ethnic cleansing and collateral damage. Phrases meant to disguise the violence and brutality of government action by dressing it up in the respectable attire of diplomatic vagary. Phase one of the new government policy involved a scheme of forced labor. Pharaoh's officials would go throughout the countryside and pluck up the Israelites from the places where they were currently working and shipped them out to the royal brickyards and wheat fields. It was these conscripted Hebrews who manned the construction crews that toiled in the roiling Egyptian heat and broiling summer sun to build the supply cities, the grain stores of Pithom and Ramesses for Pharaoh. Only the official policy of oppression by forced labor did not succeed in meeting its intended target. In fact, it had the opposite effect. For the more that the Israelites were oppressed, the more ruthlessly they were suppressed, the more they multiplied and spread out, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. Curious, isn't it, that punishing the minority population only made them stronger and more fearsome in the eyes of the majority population? And yet, rather than reviewing carefully or analyzing critically the obvious failure of government policy to meet its target, Pharaoh decided to intensify his effort. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in field labor of every kind. After all, goes the reasoning, if a policy or a program or a point of view doesn't work, why change it when you can refuse to admit you're wrong and be hailed and lauded for adhering to your principles? Well, when forcing the laborers to produce more bricks succeeded only in producing more Israelites, Pharaoh introduced a new government policy that he called family planning, but which looked to the Israelites a lot like genocide. The king ordered the Hebrew midwives, when they attended a birth, to first discern the sex of the child. If it was a boy, they were to kill the boy instantly. If it was a girl, she was to be allowed to live. It was indeed a policy of genocide by gradual attrition and population control by child murder. But to their eternal credit, the Hebrew midwives would have no part in the slaughter of their own people. And so in a courageous act of civil disobedience, they did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded, and they let the boys live. Perhaps having taken a lesson from the first failed government policy, this time round, Pharaoh was more careful in his review, more critical in his analysis of another failed government policy. When he asked them why it was they had allowed the baby boys to live, the Hebrew midwives, well, told a little white lie. They played to Pharaoh's apparent racial prejudices. Clearly, Pharaoh believed that the Hebrew people were less than human, and the midwives played along, oh, these Hebrew women, they said, they're like animals. They're vigorous. They give birth too quickly. When the midwife actually arrives, the baby has already been born. There's just nothing we could do. Well, if Pharaoh didn't know much about history, he didn't know much about biology either. Because the term for Hebrew women is exactly the same term for Egyptian women. But when you can't see the humanity of another person, you're prepared to believe virtually any untruth you are told. And Pharaoh accepted the women's story. Now, if there weren't so much at stake, it might be quite funny that Pharaoh, the ruler of one of the world's major superpowers, is outwitted by these two very modest Hebrew midwives. But herein is the difference. Pharaoh knew only how to deal shrewdly with people, namely to rule by fear because he himself was ruled by fear. Fear of the other, fear of the outsider, fear of the alien, fear of the unknown, which he then sought to subjugate and to control and to manage. Now, interestingly, friends, the Hebrew midwives also had a fear, only they feared God. They worshiped God. They held God in awe. They were reverent toward God. They feared God more than they feared Pharaoh. And so they would not resort to Pharaoh's shrewd tactics. They would not employ Pharaoh's crude schemes. In the face of a death-dealing state, the Hebrew midwives were intent upon participating with the work of God in bringing life into the world. They entrusted themselves and their future. They entrusted their very personal well-being into the hands of God. Now, because this second government policy of genocide by midwife did not work, Pharaoh ordered all of his people to insist in the execution of his genocidal plan. Now, every boy that was born to the Hebrews was to be summarily thrown into the Nile, but every girl was to be allowed to live. Clearly, Pharaoh didn't understand the power of women to bring life into the world. The conditions in which the children of God were now forced to live staggers the imagination. I can think they must be like only those inhabited by their descendants. in the Jewish ghettos of Warsaw and Krakow and Berlin, in Nazi Germany. Every pregnancy now brought not the prospect of the joy of new life, but the very real prospect of death and pain and loss. And yet, despite these awful, terrible, literally life-threatening conditions, life among the children of Israel, life among the people of God went on, even in their oppressive bondage. And we are told that a man from the house of Levi thought that if she loved him too, if the Levite woman of his dreams loved him, they could be happy together. And so he went and married her, and she conceived and gave birth to a son. Amidst the state policies of forced labor and genocide, and in this incredible atmosphere of fear and oppression, a man and a woman sang that there was much that they did not know. But they did love each other, and no power on earth could stop that. Doing things as simple as falling in love and getting married and having a child amounted to acts of defiance and raw danger. The American philosopher George Santayana, who described himself as naught but an aesthetic Catholic, once said that people who feel themselves to be exiles in this world are mightily inclined to believe themselves to be citizens of another. And that is how Moses' parents must have believed their world to be. They must have known that Egypt was not their home, their true home, their real home. Egypt was instead a place of sojourn and travail. Their true home, like their hearts and their loyalty, lay in a realm far beyond Egypt, even beyond this world. And so they could do something as courageous and as dangerous as falling in love and getting married and bringing a baby boy into the world, even in the face of oppressive brutality and state-sanctioned killing. Now, friends, I don't know much about geography, don't know much trigonometry, but I do know that one and one is two, and that two is all it takes to make a difference. Two Hebrew midwives who refused the murderous order of a king. Two Levites who denied Pharaoh's edict. Two women, one a princess, one a pauper, who rescued a child cast upon the waters. All of them had made a decision. All of them had taken a chance. All of them shared with God in changing the world. Friends, you and I can do the same. When we make a decision to love and not to hate, when we take a chance to trust and not to fear, when we believe that God is in the business of bringing forth life upon the earth and take a stand against the very powers of the world, we have the power with God to change that world. And what a wonderful world it would be.